This is Ms. G giving you Telling Tales tonight, here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And tonight's story, Catherine Vaz's What the Conch Shell Sings When the Body is Gone. It took a long time to fill the enormous tank in their living room. Meredith dragged in the garden hose and Ray adjusted the stepladder so that he could direct the water over the rim. Their rented Victorian on Divisadero reached cathedral ceilings. The tank was plexiglass, 15 feet tall and 12 feet wide, acquired through a phone call to his father's company, a supplier of containers, whether to circuses, institutes of marine biology, or furniture conglomerates. Men used a gigantic dolly to convey the tank through the back garden and past the open French doors. Meredith and Ray were water people. In their years together, they'd shared a fascination with anything aquatic. But they no longer went swimming as they used to. They did not visit the ocean often, even though it was a short drive away. She was afraid of scuba diving, and they enjoyed the fanciful notion that if they mastered the holding of their breaths, they could go lower than the snorkeling tourists and get to the stunning blue-lipped triggerfish in Hawaii, which they talked about visiting. And wouldn't that be simply heaven? But now they hardly talked at all. She found a book by an underwater photographer, a gift from him. Swimmers wearing little or nothing in pools, lakes, tanks. The pictures fleshed out her idea of happiness, eyes shut with rapture at the body being suspended, as if the people in the photos were dropped to safety from a height. Look how peaceful they were, their skin almost melting, ravishing beyond belief. The business with the tank and timing themselves started as a joke that became a game that became a method of dealing with the silence in the house. Their bathing suits were stale from disuse, polite, courtly, almost. They took turns mounting the ladder. There was a 5-foot clearance between the tank's lip and the ceiling. Immersed, Meredith bubbled the water with exhalations so that she appeared to be boiling. She was tall and pale. Her shade of hair was apricot. Her page boy was unchanged through a decade of marriage. Ray timed her at 22 seconds. She whip-kicked to the surface and climbed out, her suit sagging. She took the stopwatch. He lasted 32.33 seconds, though they lacked any interest in training to compete. They tracked their scores on a whiteboard. They scared quite a laugh. Tom Sietis's breath-holding world record for being in water without inhaling bottled oxygen beforehand was 10 minutes and 12 seconds. They'd never get that close. On Sundays, she always cooked Eggs Benedict from a recipe popular at Bridal, the restaurant near the Presidio in Cow Hollow on Chestnut, where she was a sous chef. Ray also liked toast and marmalade. The vitreous orange of it marbled with what looked disturbingly like burst capillaries. Today, a red dot marred her soft poached egg. Ray played a recording of Handel's Harp Concerto so loudly that Meredith could swear the vibration entered their utensils so that they ate breakfast with tuning forks. "Do you want more?" she said, because it was easier to ask than, "Are you having an affair?" "No," he said, more sharply than necessary, not looking at her. They were childless. Meredith blamed their hours over the years. She put in nights at Bridal. Ray worked days at the host of a cooking show filmed in the Culinary Channel studio at Fort Mason. Endless periods of standing caused a continual knife-like pain to shoot into her legs. The hotshot young chef favored creating foam on the plates. Foam this, foam that. It looked like spit. She abhorred it. When she cut her hands, he ordered her to squeeze lemons to teach her to be careful. She was old enough to be his mother. At the kitchen's porthole window, she gazed into the dining room, where the clientele seemed like children. "Wait on me, feed me," in some eternal realm, while she dodged eddies of burning chaos. Lifting her fingers off the fogged-up window, she left behind the shape of a clamshell. She struggled to find openings to speak to her husband. The agony of that. They'd been friends, really, for just about forever before they'd married. Had moaned out about their separate heartbreaks until he'd said, "Shall we save each other from this pointless waste of time?" She was fascinated at how far people could go to defy the body's limits. Many variations of static apnea exist. In 1993, Alejandro Ravelo held his breath in a pool for 6 minutes and 41 seconds. In 2008, David Blaine lasted 17.4 in a vat on the Oprah Winfrey Show, but inhaled plenty of bottled oxygen ahead of time. He was an illusionist. Some people asked if he could be trusted. Tom Sietas broke this record on Live with Regis and Kelly, 17.19 seconds. There's free diving with and without fins and with weights to plummet on one breath for a distance. But Meredith's heroine was Annette Kellerman. The Australian called the million-dollar mermaid because she'd performed ballet in tanks filled with tables, plates, chairs, and lamps, as if to say, "This is home, and I am breathless dream inside it." Annette was selected in 1908 by a Harvard professor as the perfect woman because her contours were a virtual match for Venus de Milo's. Ray Locke was 1 year shy of 40, and Meredith Paganelli Locke was 45. They'd married when he was 29 and she was 35, both of them young back then. Now they'd slipped into a new category, Ray still young but Meredith middle-aged. He'd proposed at the Japanese tea garden, the stream gurgling below the lacquered bridge, when they were rising stars at a restaurant inspired by Alice Walters. He grew up in a wealthy clan on Russian Hill, but she was the only child of elderly Italian parents in the sunset with a view of the cables for the In Judah streetcar, vacillating like tight ropes. Different worlds, but she and Ray met at high school food competitions at the Moscone Center, and one day in his mother's spotless kitchen, they concocted a sourdough starter that exploded. And who could say why that tickled them with such horror and delight that it led to walks to buy joss sticks in Chinatown and her showing him how to whisper into a corner at the Neptune Society Columbarium so that his words traveled past the ashes of many pioneers and entered her ear in a far corner. And every Halloween they climbed to the Twin Towers to drink wine stolen from his father's cellar and gazing down at the city glittering like pearls blinking a message in a black sea. Who can say why they did not think of kissing, but felt instead a peace that held them fast? At a dive in the hate over poisonous drinks with her girlfriends, Meredith wondered aloud about the affair. "Do you have proof?" asked Beth Ann. "It's gone to his head having his own show," said Lindsay on her third drink. Susan chimed in that groupie types do it with anybody on television. Meredith should ask her friend Eve, who was Ray's director. "I'd stab him in the heart," said Teresa. And during the gales of laughter, Meredith set down her martini in a panic because the bar seemed to be filling with something that was rising and lapping at her chin. The sconces were tendrils electric with light. Beth Ann voted for it being Lola, a platinum blonde ex-girlfriend of Ray's. "Lola's trouble," Teresa said. Maybe, though, it was a lot of silly groupie chef show girls hanging about the studio. Susan asked if she'd made a mistake to buy these spiked heels that, by the way, were killing her feet, and she hoisted her foot with its stylish shoe onto the table. Teresa screamed with amusement, constructing a plot for them all to lie in wait, catch Ray red-handed. Their faces looked buttery, their mouths stretched, their hair sprouted into fright wigs. In the ladies' room, sloshed, Meredith splashed water on her brow. She couldn't find the words to say to them, "But he's my best friend." Or at least he was. He hugged to himself the knowledge, almost sexual in its intensity, that he could stop before any damage, while simultaneously knowing just as powerfully that there was no way to hold back. The exquisite pleasure of going past the verge, drowning in kisses and frantic, stolen grasping. Of course, there came the inevitable tipping into lies. Meredith waited at the War Memorial Opera House, the car sailing by on Van Ness. Tonight was Tristan and Isolde. Her cell phone rang. Ray said he'd be filming late. He taught audiences how to cook inexpensive, fast dinners. "Leave my ticket at the will call window, and I'll join you after intermission, I hope." Her teal gown was backless with a fishtail. She cinched the belt of her raincoat. A summertime mist was forcing the crowd inside. She gave away for free both tickets to a young couple, Wagner devotees who were ecstatic. While treating herself to a Napoleon in a pastry shop, the fellow at the counter asked if she was married and wanted to be invisible. Not thinking, she replied, "No." He drawled, "So what's that on your finger?" She recalled an old joke as she held up her diamond band. "This? This is to keep the flies off." His grin was savagely unwavering until she squirmed and rose up and paid and fled, transparent even to strangers. Eve Robidoux invited Meredith to the ferry building for an afternoon of teas. She ordered herself iced in a glass so cold it was weeping. She thanked Meredith for getting her into rehab years ago right after they'd met as line cooks at Bridal. Meredith had urged Eve to get into television after Eve repeatedly harped about cooking being a bore, unending hard work and nothing permanent to show for it. Bloated whales came and ate up your handiwork. It had been Meredith who put Ray in her care when he voiced the same frustration with being a chef. "We're worried, Mary," said Eve, fiddling with her saucer. "You look down." Tea made Meredith slightly ill, but Eve loved how it announced her being past an obsession with scotch. Her parents had paid for the stay at a rehab favored by celebrities. Her childhood was like Ray's, pony rides at birthday parties, winter intercessions in Gestad, where the wealthy dispensed with a sensible placement of vowels. Her parents shelled out the clams to get her into that culinary temple, Le Cordon Bleu, in Paris, and their princess could throw away what she'd learned there. Eve was a seductive example of being worry-free, of moving on. She was compact, dazzling. At 32, she could pass for 20. Meredith's shaking hands spilled some tea that painted a maple leaf onto the tablecloth. "Are you ill? Should I worry about you?" said Eve, her expression knitted in concern. "Oh, a touch of something. Flu. I'm fine," said Meredith, clattering down her cup. Her sheltered childhood gladdened by visits to the tomato frogs at the Steinhardt Aquarium. Wearing a boucle suit for an interview for a cooking post at the Seawolf restaurant. After not getting the job, she learned to wear clogs and bring her set of knives. Her vacations with her elderly parents consisted of trips down the highway to a cabin in Santa Cruz owned by her aunt and uncle, who dived for abalone and spent the afternoons in raucous arguments while pounding the meat to tenderize it. Pried loose, abalone is a mussel, little else. The aunt and uncle lined their fence with the shelves, the opalescent pans like baptismal fonts, hot and gleaming from the beating of the sun. He relished the illusion, knowing it to be that of control. Stroking Eve's flat stomach, her breast riding her inhalations, he said, "That seemed mean somehow, to ask her out so you could study her. I wanted to make sure she's fine. Should we tell her?" He repeated this, and Eve frowned, her fingertips with their neon polish kneading his thigh. A reply would involve guessing if she and Ray would go the distance. "Come here," she said. Eve had taught him the term bed hair. She twisted her dark blonde waves into a rope she tossed onto her back. Her skin was flawless, her eyes sapphire glass. She was porous, always ready to be entered. He kissed her deeply, and she encircled his neck. The slats of shadow in her Market Street loft, her parents had paid for that, too, in full, plastered ripples over them as a tide refigures sand. Meredith showed a novice pastry chef how strudel dough should be stretched under the sheet of it. Slowly move the backs of your hands. Sudden motions will tear it. A sonorous composure is required. "Pretend you're playing a harp that's tipped onto its side," Meredith said gently, her knuckles small pink bumps under the buttered veil. A kind of quiet patience, that was what she and Ray had, and while that was not wild abandon and desperate gripping of each other and never had been, it evokes St. John to the Corinthians, those tender lines about love that vaunts not itself, does not struggle. Back when they were just friends, Meredith taught him ballroom dancing. She was expert at it once. She'd crossed over into better fondness while he was dating someone else. She spent so many hours one week helping him rehearse to impress his new love that blood filled her shoes. Her womb happened to be bleeding. Her fingers were bandaged from her classes at the Culinary Academy. Shy to the point of muteness, she waited and grew herbs and planters that quaked with the passing streetcar. She and her friends practiced Italian from language tapes. They fed their fixation with Rome, that grandly crumbling city doused in liquid sun. Meredith and Ray played their breath-holding game when their schedules allowed. Alone one day, she plunged in and felt as limpid as those see-through shrimp that are visible only because of the filament of food moving in their gut. The sea, God's bathtub, God's bath toys. He dawdles there, puzzling out, via fish, a physical model to fix his original design of human love. Each male angler fish bites an available female and hangs on, fusing to her forever, feeding off her wherever she goes. Bonds that made flesh seamless. Meredith's mother had died in her sleep a few years back, and then her father followed 10 days later, almost to the same hour. While floating and mulling, a bolt hit Meredith out of the lucid blue. Eve. My God, my husband is sleeping with my friend Eve. I sent him to her when he wanted more than hiding in a kitchen. Eve, with that intoxicating mix of being sweet and commanding. And Meredith trembled so much that night in bed that she and Ray turned to each other at some point lying in the dark, not making love, but she found his arms natural and warm and the curve of his long body as comfortable as a hammock set on its side. She clicked into his email and found the erotic pleadings, the breathless anticipation. Never would she have imagined violating his privacy so fearlessly. He quit wearing bathing trunks in the tank. What was he, 90? Hey, where's the shuffleboard? He and Meredith were never naked anymore. They had not made love for 2 years. God forbid they talk about it. Without his glasses, the room outside the tank seemed to dissolve and suggest that the Impressionist painters were onto something. There's beauty in slicing through outlines, boundaries. Today he'd bought radishes, eagerly showed the camera's eye how, with a few easy, deep cuts, anyone could convert them into flowers. The heady danger of pretending that all would work out, all being deliberately vague and tragically inclusive, Eve directed him to smile and fill the airspace by chatting about himself while washing his hands to demonstrate proper hygiene after handling chicken breasts. At her loft, he showed her how to score and cube a mango off its skin. "Like this?" she giggled, getting it wrong on purpose. "Like this," he said. Oh, her kissing him, "like this." Or how about "like this?" "Like this? Love this." Their limbs a tango, him behind her directing her hand with the knife. Much later, he would replay that chicken episode on YouTube because he'd invited her to join him on camera, but she gestured, "Oh no, I couldn't." But her hand had entered the filming of the scene, and he couldn't resist hitting pause again and again to look at it. That five-pointed starfish scuttling over the shoreline, separating the unseen from the seen. At a low ebb, out with the girls, Meredith reported slaving over a wedding cake only to have a drunken guest punch his fist into it. Aghast, she'd asked why he'd done it. "Because I can," he'd barked, lurching away. Lindsay said, "Wait, wait, Mary. You spent days on it and he ruined it in a second?" "I'd be crazed," said Beth Ann. Susan demanded to know if Meredith had quizzed her pal Eve at the TV studio about the girls Ray was bedding in the bedroom closet. In the broom closet. Insert here much gaiety. "I'd be in orbit," said Teresa, as if it was unclear if she meant over Ray or the cake despoiler. Meredith sipped her club soda and drifted back to the days when she and Ray decided to gamble their friendship and become engaged, and how giddy they were at their daring, strolling along China Beach, the waves ribbed vertically with foam so that they looked like king-size hair combs churned loose from the tabletops of the vanities of whales. It would, in the time still to come, strike him as unfathomably, mercilessly cruel to have watched Meredith sautéing onions for a nothing-fancy dinner caught in boiled potatoes while he yakked about Eve's idea for a brand-new show, Grand Escapes. She'd research menus from around the globe, and instead of risking the chopping block with his show's good but not great ratings about cooking on cheap, he could help viewers travel far without leaving their homes. Patatas, bravas, pan perdu, tandoori. "I'll do the research, you're the talent," Eve had practically shouted. "It'll be unbelievable." For the love of God, his regaling Meredith with this reminded him of how he sounded when he burdened her with the plot of a movie she'd missed. Look at her holding a mask of placidity. He knew her well, how to justify that hidden pleasure of carving the line of decency so close, to speak Eve's name aloud over and over so casually, innocently, just to hear it, to wallow in the presumed safety and thrill of it right then. They sat reading magazines in their living room. The cherry wood buffet had such ancient panes that they rattled at the softest step on the wooden floor, and so the glass chattered when Meredith decided to get a drink of sparkling water from the kitchen, and she stopped and asked if he'd like her to get one for him, too. He was overcome with such a storm of love and regret that he bit his lip and his eyes pooled with tears that he told himself he had no right to spring. Her chest rose and fell where she stood watching him. And then came a moment they would both remember for the rest of their lives, because who can hope for another instance of such divine connection? "Jesus Christ," he blurted, "and I don't know why I'm saying this, Mary, but is Beethoven's Ninth running through your head?" He tapped his left temple. "Your mind gets so loud sometimes I think I can hear it too." She was startled. Her palms flew to her mouth. She walked to him, and he laid his head on her chest so her arms could circle him lightly, and his glasses slipped off, and they rocked like that for a short while before she whispered, "Yes, I was at the part when the chorus goes insane, chanting joy, joy, joy." Annette Kellerman was born with a defect in her leg that required braces until she found that moving through water cured her. Her performances in a tank at the New York Hippodrome gave birth to synchronized swimming. Her one-piece skin-tight bathing suit got her arrested on a Boston beach, and though she didn't understand the fuss, the world soon adopted her invention. She stayed married to a man she adored, rich and famous in her lifetime and recognized as an artist. Annette reigned in a floating kingdom. Her hunger for water expanded into religion. Meredith in the tank told herself, if you can hold your breath for 1 second, you can endure a second longer. Her personal best was 1 minute, 25 seconds, 0.2 milliseconds. Ray's was 52 minutes, 0.7 seconds. You waited with bated breath. You declined to accept that bated also means the violent anger and fury of a roused hawk. She cornered Eve at the TV studio. Ray was in a corner wearing a paper collar while the woman powdered the shine off his high forehead. Meredith lost her voice with Eve, then found it. "Is it true? What are you planning with Ray?" Eve hardly moved. That smooth veneer of the easeful childhood that alternated with a sheen of addiction. Eve showed Meredith the clipboard she was gripping and said, "We're planning to show how to grind your own spices, Mary. You can stay and watch." Meredith could scarcely control her limbs as she stormed out. Ray strode after her, and she broke into a run. The lure of breath-holding is how it violates the laws of the gods. Fasting, meditation, and prior hyper-breathing can prolong submersion. Uncanny how many souls risk blackout, bloody lungs, damaged tissue, burst veins, death. Legend has it that the Amma divers of Japan brought up pearls, but the truth is more workaday. Mostly, they brought up abalones to sell, then knacker interiors. She screamed at some apprentices at Bridal who thought it would be hilarious to use beef stock for the vegetarian special. In the middle of the night with Ray sleeping, she drank a bottle of wine, seized his ID card, and swiped her way into the Culinary Channel studio. He told her that the subject of the next day's filming would be lamb stew. And it took more than an hour for her to march the vats of it and the pans filled with the breakdown of the stages of preparation out to her car. She took the food to St. Vincent's shelter. Ha! Look at tomorrow's neat little script turned into nothing. So much energy squandered on being foolish. Ray almost got fired for having no idea how to improvise. Eve saved the day by defrosting some trout, taking center stage and showing how to fillet and grill fish, skinning and boning it with a surgical skill that won her applause. She did not have to ponder much to figure out who had sabotaged everyday triumphs, and she phoned a bridal and told the young chef. Meredith's work had been suffering. She burned orders. She was a sleepwalker. While chiding Meredith, the young chef smirked and said, "If you're going to steal hundreds of dollars worth of lamb, at least bring it here." At first, she was desperate to be fired, anything but his jollity at her distress. But when he wondered out loud if the kitchen's fumes had steam-cooked her brain, she absorbed in an instant the truth that genuine adulthood comes when one does not run off because of shame, when one stays and demands a home. She roamed among the cosmetic counters at Macy's, seeking potions, wrinkle creams, hydrating salves. Skeletal women in tight black dresses held atomizers and spritzed her with rose and lilac mist. Their tuberous fingers waved like polypi, motioning her closer to the pots of coral paste, the shallow pans of shadows. A trickling sound issued from their walls. It suspected brocade patches of mold and split pipes too expensive to get to. Meredith wondered if a crack had sprung in the plexiglass. In homage to Annette, she put items in the water, a battered tea kettle, a dial telephone, a broken lock from her gym bag, the shipwrecked items of ordinary existence. Midway through their 10-year marriage, Meredith had had a fling. The word evoked a stick thrown as far as possible. That Ray, so far as she knew, was ignorant of. Marcus was a principal dancer with the San Francisco Ballet, and she still went to recall the final meeting, the 27th in the span of 3 months, the afternoon at the Fairmount, segueing into a grindingly awful finish in the parking lot of Muir Woods, the breezes ripping tufts of furry bark off the redwoods and pelting Marcus's Cadillac. He was announcing he'd found someone new. When she asked what she'd done, he said nothing. It's the end we expected. They'd gone to concerts and lured to go dancing with him. He'd clutched her once and moaned how much he needed her. "I could fall in love with you, you know." He'd said that. She'd said it back. Could. At the cable car museum, over the ear-assaulting whine of the gears, as the frayed cables were getting soldered to a safer thickness, he'd asked if she could see herself ever living in London, his native city. She started breaking down in his car at Muir Woods, stopped mercifully, short of pleading. But when she said she was shocked and ready to cry, he shouted, "Shocked?" A straight ballet dancer could have his pick of women. Why, it was a parade. Air refused to enter her lungs. She pushed against the passenger's door, but it was as if she were drowning in a car. The utter shame of her fantasies, the gentle but firm praising she'd rehearsed to tell Ray she was leaving him, her heady mirages of soaring in that stratosphere where Marcus traveled, and the ether of the talented and famous, her sharply outlined mental pictures of gadding about London, the girlish rush of seeing a star leaping on stage after he'd sidled up to her at a charity fundraiser and invited her to spend the night. When Ray had asked her why she was so sad, she'd replied, "Because how can I feel so old without having grown up?" At an extremity of breath-holding, a little talked about occurrence is a buckling of the body, a triggering of the sexual nerves and arousal, sexual asphyxiation beckons. At 2.1, this frightened Meredith almost to death, and Ray jumped in to rescue her. She lay heaving and sobbing on the floor, and they called an end to everything. What was the prize? They hadn't concocted one. What was the point? Why hadn't they thought clear to the eventual need to drain the tank? They formed a bucket brigade, dashing the water into the garden, and the task was so laborious and ridiculous that they laughed. And when the men arrived to cart the tank away, Meredith and Ray held hands. They had not touched like this in so long that it was like an electrical prod to the tails of their spines. With her hair tied into the top knot that they referred to as her Pebbles Flintstone, while wearing her UC Santa Cruz t-shirt with its marinara stain near the banana slug mascot, because who cares if I look like hell, she cooked an omelet that was the most perfect he'd ever seen or smelled or tasted. It was plain. He was about to reach across the table and say, "I do so love you," and but he had no idea how to complete his sentence, and during that pause she said she knew that he was leaving her, even if he didn't. Yet. His rib cage ached. "She'll take your show from you, Ray," she said, her back to him, clearing the plates. "How do you know?" he managed. He should have said, "I'm drowning, forgive me, come here." "It's what pushy women do," she screamed. She shattered a plate against a wall. In the manner of wronged vixens in movies, which had always struck him as too theatrical and deranged to occur in actual life, they want to direct you and then eat you alive. When he grabbed her arm, she blazed. "Go on, men think they'll live forever," she spat out. Beth Ann insisted that Meredith and Lindsay join her in toasting Ray's departure. "Good riddance," she cried. Lindsay hooted. "His show sucks anyhow. Cooking shows are porn, stuff we watch but don't get to eat." Meredith chomped wasabi peas so she didn't have to speak, and when she choked, they pounded her back. How happy her friends were now that she joined their club of the Solitary Furies. While packing to move to an apartment on Green Street, she decided to prick her anguish by watching Everyday Triumphs. And what do you know? Eve was on camera with him, teamed up. She shut off the set, but walking past the silent box, she couldn't help but see her husband still bobbing behind the glass, as if in a flat aquarium, trapped in the everlasting digital dots that pass for immortality. The tank had soaked through the floor. Her boxes of childhood things in the basement were rotted. Her Chatty Cathy doll's hair sprouted mange. Her school papers were a smear. Her plastic mermaid from an old fish bowl was corroded, her arms arrested in uplift like the priest during the major elevation when he declares, "This is my body." She would come to associate his new marriage with pumpkins, because his wedding was in the autumn following their divorce. Squash soup was on the menu at bridal. A blade slipped and she needed stitches. Pumpkin lattes and candle smoke seeping out of the detailed dentaled smile of jack-lanterns. She pretended she could inhale his wedding as an aroma of fall. "Meredith, what were you thinking?" scolded Beth Ann. "You snuck into his reception at the Palace of Fine Arts. The wind threatened to overturn the tables under the sand-colored dome." Meredith hid behind a colonnade, unnerved to be in a pose like the female statues at the top of the dome, looked mournfully down, grieving at the thought of a world without art. Guzzling champagne until she drooled froth, Meredith pitied a tipsy bridesmaid wading into the lagoon. Ray gave a speech about his new bride, thanked her for saving him from loneliness. Eve gazed straight into his eyes in a way Meredith was pretty sure she herself had never managed. Even at a distance, anyone could see that the welded vision of Ray to Eve was carrying them already to their wedding bed. She could picture them entwined. The bed is soaked. The rest of the world drops away. Meredith staggered to the wharf, let the spray hit her. A sailor was dropping stones to send widening circles into the bay. At the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, she stared at a grain of rice on which a miniaturist had written the Lord's Prayer, the placard stating that each stroke of a letter was made between breaths and fast, fast light, between heartbeats, which the artist had spent years training himself to feel. The fate of the lobster is famous. Consider also the primitive practice of pouring boiling water on eels in boxes, rough enough for their writhing to scale them into a delicacy. Behind the facade, behind the counter, within the tiled place, is the steady drip caused by the kosher butcher. Consider the common blow that strikes a cow in an abattoir. For a fraction of a second, the cow stands with a shocked full register, equally alive and dead, knowing itself to be both living and gone. People realizing their moral limits drift about in a condition too profound to bellow, one foot in this world and one in another. This has been Ms. G, and I've been bringing you Telling Tales. Tonight's story, What the Conch Shell Sings When the Body is Gone by Catherine Vaz. She looked for God in her work. Her palate craved vegetables, tonic water, and creme brulee. She swam in Aquatic Cove with the Dolphin Club. She traveled and found new menus that she convinced Bridal to offer. A few pleasant men dated her until one of or the other of them lost interest. Either the passion was extreme and quick to explode, or nothing scaled past friendship. Without giddiness or rancor, she designed a fine farewell party when the young chef moved on to Dallas and the owner promoted her to head chef. She copied her favorite quote from Annette Kellerman, which extolled the powers nigh unto eternity for those who can swim their solitary course night or day and forget a black earth full of people that push. She was neither gleeful nor sad when the news reached her that Eve was hosting a popular program called Grand Escapes on her own, while Ray's show was canceled. She was neither gleeful nor sad to hear of their divorce. Whenever she picked up the phone to reach him, stuck in neutral, there was no completing the call. She sent a single word, marvelous, in block letters on a stiff card, when in her third year as head chef of Bridal, the Chronicle featured her for having won one Michelin star. He buried his father. He inherited very little. He watched a TV program that surprised him by mentioning that the Amadivers could walk around for years seeming to be fine, but suddenly, toward old age, their eyes might flare up bright red, their organs rupture. Meredith at long last took her moldy, chatty Kathy doll to a doll hospital at Hyde and Pine. A man who looked like a tailor in a children's fairy tale set aside a bisque torso he'd been gluing together to greet Meredith, who blurted, "Why do girls love pulling the heads off Barbies?" The doll doctor laughed and said, "Wow, I've often wondered." They bantered suggestions because the necks are so skinny, because it makes it easier to play hammer throw, twirling the head by the ponytail. None of this was monumental. There was nothing vital or even cosmically comic, and therefore she treasured the episode as truer to life as it's lived. God is everywhere, but more in the center of everywhere. God lies within a step altered out of the ordinary, but more within the center of that new radius of a step. At the Museum of Modern Art, staring up below the glass bridge, she saw the outline of a child's feet stopped. It can be frightening to walk that suspension. Larger feet waited next to the child's, all motionless. Meredith had a distinct sensation of sprouting cuts that were like gills. She could breathe nearly forever at the bottom of this sea. "Go on, go on. It's fine. You'll see." She sent that heavenward toward the child, and then the fruit crossed the glass bridge together. Meredith left the museum feeling rinsed and cooled. At a conference in Chattanooga about new American cuisine, she went to the Living Art Gallery, where bedding was set up for people who wanted to sleep surrounded by jellyfish. Pulsating moon jellies, transparent pink tissues like parasols. Living water. "Oh, Annette, didn't you suggest that power is born from piloting through the sea? Didn't you write that despite being a mermaid in the movies, you still devoutly desired to see a real one perched on a rock, combing her long green hair?" She ran into him at the Palace of the Legion of Honor near Rodin's The Thinker. His hairline had receded. He was back to cooking, he said, at a fusion place in the Mission District. Eve was a network star living with a high-powered lawyer. "Ah," Meredith said. He didn't degrade her by asking for forgiveness. His fists were jammed into the pockets of his jacket. She gripped his elbows. He looked at her eyes in a manner they had never fully managed. She did not know how to mention her own affair without sounding as if she were either evening the score or letting him off the hook. So they did not speak much. But their look conveyed an entirety, without any fairy tale ending. She was dating someone at the time. He was, too. But now it could happen from time to time. He could call her up and speak, and she could talk to him gladly. In her youth, her taste ran Baroque. French tapestries, layered torts. Now she craved simplicity. Consommé, distillations. Meredith Locke passed from middle age to older, but still relatively young. Her legs were marbled with varicose veins from a career on her feet, but she kept her Michelin star and her post as head chef until she turned 58. Without anxiety, without bitterness, she accepted the news one day that despite her faithful screenings, she was discovered to have breast cancer that had spread. Her time had simply arrived, and that was all. Ray Locht moved to a new restaurant, a Latin spot with cobalt walls. It would be his fate to jump from place to place, but for now he was living with a schoolteacher who was friendly with Meredith and understood how life twists about, trying to grab its tail and form circles. She told Ray to go care for Meredith and then she'd welcome him back. And so they were together again for a short while. Her pain by then was extreme. He brought her a gift he'd bought in Springfield, Illinois, ages ago but never used, a cookbook from the Civil War. In her apartment on Green Street, he prepared a carrageen blancmange. "You're the only person currently on the planet who'd like this," he said. "I love you. I adore you, you know." Her smile, the dark circles framing her eyes, the turquoise headscarf. Once upon a time, seaweed could travel to a druggist in the Midwest in the mid-19th century and cost little. It was prized as salubrious for those of a delicate constitution. The carrageen had to be washed thoroughly and boiled, and he added the barest handful to the mint, milk, bitter almonds, sugar, cinnamon, and mace. He fed it to her in spoonfuls. "My dearest," she said. In the end, one dissolves into atoms. Her affair with the ballet dancer, how was that so different from Ray with Eve? That desire for grandeur, release, and upper world. God peering down might see it all as some balanced math equation. Finally, wasn't it the strangest thing that passion should ebb with long knowing, and yet people are born to want to find the one? Wasn't that the great human dilemma? What if a person aimed to find God within physicality, to have bodily desire increase? What idiocy to separate God's love from tactile human love? At the shoreline it lands in, Ray and Meredith stood bundled up. Bless Annette Kellerman, who said that water taught modesty of the soul. She remarked cheerily that, "After leaving the shore behind, I seemed to shrink and shrink till I was nothing but a flecky bubble and feared that the bubble would burst." But they were beyond words now. His arms were around her and hers around him. He leaned down to kiss her at the exact second that she lifted her face to meet his in a lingering kiss. It is the kiss of their lives. The salted air, the sea rushes in to cover their bare feet with a spume of lace. The hermit crabs rest below the wet sand, their breathing holes like straws to drink in the tide. The tide ceaseless in its approach and retreat. It's coming toward and going away. It's brimming with peril even as it fully possesses the kind of rhythm slowed since the dawn of time for how it sings a body to sleep. That was "What the Conch Shell Sings When Your Body Is When the Body Is Gone" by Catherine Vaz. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G. Thank you.